Hello, and thank you for joining us in Mapping the Zone, a podcast dedicated to a highly fixated review of large, dense books, usually, in particular, the works of context of Thomas Pynchon. My name is Will, and I am your host for today. Today, I'm going to be talking to you all, about a book that's a little bit out of the ordinary for these bonus episodes, in the sense that it is not fiction. I'm going to be talking about Pilgrim at Tinker Creek by Annie Dillard today. And what I'm going to preface all of this with is by saying, you know, Annie Dillard is a very renowned author with a wide bibliography, and I have not read most of her works. I've read a few others, but this is going to be talking about Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, in and of itself. I am not a minister, so I'm not schooled in theodicy. And I have not read Walden. All of these things are very relevant to this book. I'm not going to be bringing any of them up. So, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, for those of you who do not know, is a 1975 Pulitzer nonfiction award-winning book that is sometimes considered to be a collection of essays, and if you ask the author, she would say that it is a single continuous narrative. And I think that the truth of how to approach the book is either way goes. I think you can view it as nature writing, nonfiction, just somebody talking about what's going on in their neck of the woods, or you can view it as a sort of extended apotheosis of nature and the matter of being a viewer as a human. And in many ways, you can talk about it as the way that people today, with an asterisk being that this was written in the early 70s, the way that modern people view nature as something separate but also inescapable. And I think that it's this is a good book for anybody who A, enjoys flowery nature writing, B, enjoys the more philosophical diatribes that Thomas Pynchon goes into, or even somebody who's just interested in kind of getting into essays, nonfiction, narrative fiction, nonfiction narratives as a form. If you look into this book, there's one passage that comes up quite a bit, and I'm just going to read it, because I think that it's a really good indication of what the book, as coming to it as a reader, what the book is going to give you. A couple of summers ago, I was walking along the edge of the island to see what I could see in the water, and mainly to scare frogs. Frogs have an inelegant way of taking off from invisible positions on the bank just ahead of your feet, in dire panic, emitting a froggy yik, and splashing into the water. Incredibly, this amused me, and incredibly, it amuses me still. As I walked along the grassy edge of the island, I got better and better at seeing frogs both in and out of the water. I learned to recognize, slowing down, the difference in texture of the light reflected from mud bank, water, grass, or frog. Frogs were flying all around me. At the end of the island, I noticed a small green frog. He was exactly half in and half out of the water, looking like a schematic diagram of an amphibian. And he didn't jump. He didn't jump. I crept closer. At last, I knelt on the island's winter-killed grass, lost, dumbstruck, staring at the frog in the creek just 4 feet away. He was a very small frog with wide, dull eyes, and just as I looked at him, he slowly crumpled and began to sag. The spirit vanished from his eyes as if snuffed. His skin emptied and drooped. His very skull seemed to collapse and settle like a kicked tent. He was shrinking before my eyes like a deflating football. I watched the taut, glistening skin on his shoulders ruck and rumple and fall. Soon, part of his skin, formless as a pricked balloon, lay in floating folds like bright scum on top of the water. It was a monstrous and terrifying thing. I gaped, bewildered, appalled. An oval shadow hung in the water behind the drained frog. Then the shadow glided away. The frog skin began to sink. And that's the story of a frog getting eaten by a giant water bug. And much of the book is these little anecdotes of Annie Dillard going on a walk, chain-smoking cigarettes, and just watching life around her in Tinker Creek, in, I believe, Southern Virginia.
I mean, that sounds like a good time to me.
I think it is. It's a fun book that's full of some truly beautiful, peaceful nature writing. But it's also interspersed with that horrible imagery of just life.
So you started out by saying that you weren't a minister. What is the intersection between this and religion? I'm curious.
So a big part of this book, beyond the simple nature writing, is an attempt, it seems, for the young Dillard, who was 27, I think, when she was writing this book, to really kind of situate herself in the universe. And so there's a lot of discussion in the book about the nature of evil and about the irreducibility of the complexity of life and how that leads, by comparison, humans to the horrible things that humans do. And the way that we subconsciously on some levels and very consciously on others differentiate that from the kinds of quiet terror that happen all around us all the time.
Okay, gotcha.
All right, so what I'm going to do now is, because I can't find any specific quotes which highlight what I'm trying to bring up, I'm going to walk through kind of the way that this book builds a lexicon of symbols from which you can start to, as a reader, piece together the more philosophical discussions from the baseline of her just walking around and looking at animals. The point I want to make about the snakeskin is that when I found it, it was whole and tied in a knot. Now, there have been stories told, even by reputable scientists, of snakes that have deliberately tied themselves in a knot to prevent larger snakes from trying to swallow them, but I couldn't imagine any way that throwing itself into a half hitch would help a snake trying to escape its skin. Still, ever cautious, I figured that one of the neighborhood boys could possibly have tied it in a knot in the fall, for some whimsical boyish reason, and left it there, where it dried and gathered dust. So I carried the skin along thoughtlessly as I walked, snagging it sure enough on a low branch and ripping it in two for the first of many times. I saw that thick ice still lay on the quarry pond and that the skunk cabbage was already out in the clearings. And then I came home and looked at the skin and its knot. The knot had no beginning. Idly I turned it around in my hand, searching for a place to untie. I came to with a start when I realized it. I must have turned the thing around fully 10 times. Intently, then, I traced the knot's lump around with a finger. It was continuous. I couldn't untie it any more than I could untie a donut. It was a loop without a beginning or end. These snakes are magic, I thought for a second. Then, of course, I reasoned what must have happened. The skin had been pulled inside out like a peeled sock for several inches. Then an inch or so of the inside-out part, a piece whose length was coincidentally equal to the diameter of the skin, had somehow been turned right side out again, making a thick lump whose edges were lost in wrinkles, looking exactly like a knot. So I must have been thinking about a change of seasons. I don't want to miss spring this year. I want to distinguish the last winter frost from out-of-season one, the frost of spring. I want to be there on the spot the moment the grass turns green. I always miss this radical revolution. I see it the next day from a window. The yards are suddenly green and lush. I could envy Nebuchadnezzar down on all fours eating grass. Nebuchadnezzar, I believe, is her cat. This year I want to stick a net into time and say now, as men plant flags on the ice and snow and say here. But it occurred to me that I could no more catch spring by the tip of the tail than I could untie the apparent knot in the snakeskin. There are no edges to grasp. Both are continuous loops. And as the story, I suppose, I'll call it, goes along, it slowly builds from these small little moments, which have that kind of obvious connection with the rest of life, to these large cacophonies, which let me see really quick. There's an afterword in my copy of the book where she talks a little bit about her own process in writing the novel, Annie Dillard does. And what she says is that the book's first half accumulates the world's goodness and gods. And it really does culminate, as she says, in this chapter, Intricacy, which features this paragraph. Intricacy means that there is a fluted fringe to something that exists over against it, that exists over against nothing. A fringe that rises and spreads, a burgeoning in detail. Mentally reverse positive and negative space, as in the plaster cast of the pine, and imagine emptiness, a sort of person. A boundless person consisting of an elastic, unformed clay. For the moment, forget that the air in our atmosphere is something, and countered as nothing, the sculptor's negative space. The clay man completely surrounds the holes in him, which are galaxies and solar systems. The holes in him part. Expand, shrink, veer, circle, spin. He gives like water. He spreads and fills unseeing. Here is a ragged hole, our earth, a hole which makes torn and frayed edges in his side, mountains and pines. And here is the shape of one swift raveling edge, a feather hole on a flying goose's hollow wing extended over the planet. 500 barbs of emptiness prick into clay from either side of a central flexible shaft. On each barb are two fringes of 500 barbules apiece, making a million barbules on each feather, fluted and hooked in a matrix of clasped hollowness. Through the fabric of this form, the clay man shuttles unerringly and through the other feather holes, and the goose, the pine forest, the planet, and so on. And at this moment, you see this kind of dazzling, both of the description, although I think many people would feel that the prose is pretty purple from the get-go. But also, you see, the next stage of this evolution is into a chapter called Fecundity. And in Fecundity, the narrator discusses, well, the word itself. Webster's dictionary defines fecundity as productive or creative power. In any case, what she's talking about in this is reproduction, the kind of writhing masses that exist underneath all of our fingers, whether it's bacteria or ant hives or parasites. At this point, that convolution, the incredible intricacy which the entire book is discussing, kind of turns toward an almost what I would describe as Lovecraftian horror element of nature. The things that we don't like about the world around us, whether it's cicada larvae eating at the roots of the trees, or it's, you know, ticks gorging themselves on our blood. And what the book begins to do is really delve into the ways that these things are not different from the things that we love in any material sense, and begins to remind us, I suppose, of the fact that we are deciding to be disgusted by these things. That the frog being eaten is horrible because we like the frog, not because it is bad for the water bug to eat the frog. And I think there are very few books that I've read, at least, that do quite as good of a job of bridging the gap between those things as this book does. I think it's kind of interesting that in the afterword, this is what Annie Dillard says about her own work. How does Pilgrim at Tinker Creek seem after 25 years? Above all, and salvifically, I hope it seems bold. That it is overbold, and bold in metaphor, seems a merit. I dashed in without any fear of God. At 27, I had all the license I thought I needed to engage the greatest subjects on earth. I dashed in without any fear of man. I thought that 9 or 10 monks might read it. I'm afraid I suffered youth's drawback, too. A love of grand sentences and fancied a grand sentence was not quite done until it was overdone. Some parts seem frivolous. Its willingness to say I and me embarrasses. But at least it used the first person as a point of view only, a handheld camera directed outwards. And that's really what I think the value of this book is today. A, I think that if you are young, as in probably younger than me, if you've grown up in a city center and haven't spent much time in nature, I think that people owe it to themselves to get out there and see the world around them. And what I think this book acts as is a call to action to actually immerse yourself in those things. A reminder that we can go out and, yes, it's youthful folly to go out and to try to do your own philosophy just by watching the muskrats swim through the creek. But what it also is human and life-affirming. And so much of this little talk has been messy and disorganized, not because I don't think that this book deserves, real analysis, real thesis, but because I think that this book deserves to be read in the same way that this book can be read as saying, sure, you can read this book and enjoy all the imagery, but it's nowhere near the depth of seeing it for yourself, and it's nowhere near the depth of thinking these thoughts for yourself. What I want this podcast to be is a call to action to go read this book so that then you are then called to go walk in the woods and watch the muskrats and see a frog get eaten. Any questions?
What would it sound like for a frog to get eaten?
Ooh.
Ooh.
That was pretty good.
Very solid, yeah.
Thank you. I'll be here all week.
I don't think the recording time runs that long.
No, but I do have Audacity.
One thing I will say, you did mention Nebuchadnezzar potentially being her cat. That is actually more likely a reference to Daniel chapter 4, verses 25 through 35, if he serves me correctly, in which after Yahweh ousts King Nebuchadnezzar II from Babylon, he is cursed to spend the rest of his days wandering amongst other animals on all fours. And it specifically mentions that he'll be eating grass like other beasts of the field.
Yeah, that makes a lot more sense. This is exactly what I meant by saying I wasn't a minister. The book really is, for anyone still listening to this, and for the two of you, it really is in conversation with a wide swath of both religions and quasi-religious spiritual texts. It's very multicultural in that way.
It sounds very interesting in that regard. Like, it does certainly make me want to pick up a copy and read through it. The usage of some of the quotes that you had mixed with like the title, obviously having a direct religious connection with the idea of a pilgrimage or a pilgrim, that very much piques my interest. It's I've never heard of this before, you bringing this up just now. Obviously Walden, like everybody knows, but it seems like this one might have a bit more going on of merit than Walden does.
Yeah, like I said, I haven't read Walden, and that's mostly just out of pettiness. But I do get the sense that Walden is much more about trying to draw like political and human scale philosophical arguments out of just living in a cabin in the woods. Whereas the Pilgrim at Tinker Creek is really about the relationship with being around other beings. It's far less about the philosophy in terms of what we can draw into morality, and far more about what are the roots of our philosophies? What are the roots of our moralities? Why do we care about these things?
Mm-hmm.
I think it sounds interesting from the perspective of just it's writing on nature. As someone who spent a lot of time as a kid in the woods behind my house and camping all kinds of various places, my dad grew up on a big ranch outside of Kerrville, so his best friend still lived out there, and we would go spend weekends over the summer camping out there and just, you know, entire days walking through the woods and along the riverbanks that was out there. And I think it's, you know, like you said, it's important, I think, for everybody at some point to get out and really experience nature on that level. Not just of, you know, taking a quick walk through the woods and looking at the trees, but like really sitting down and just like watching how things happen and appreciating the life that occurs, you know, essentially in the background of our own. Because there's really some fascinating things that are happening, and just watching the way that different organisms interact with the environment and with each other, you can lose hours just watching that kind of stuff if you can find it. And you know, I think to be able to write that kind of thing as viscerally as some of the parts that you pulled is a very hard thing to do. And it seems like she does a really good job of it. So I'm really curious to find this and check it out.
Yeah, I've in an attempt to leave the listeners wanting more, and also to not just fill this bonus episode with quotes, I've left a lot of the most beautiful stuff of this book. Thank you, dog. in the book, I've chosen not to excerpt it, because it really is so. It's a very engrossing read. The actual narrative, the plot, is very limited. But while you're reading it, every little anecdote that the narrator brings you through is deeply satisfying and fascinating in that way that in real life, when you're walking along a forest path and you see, you know, a caterpillar building a cocoon, the way it just kind of grabs you. And I think, yeah, if that's what you like about nature, this book is for you. On the other hand, apparently, a lot of people give this to high school students, and as a result, if you want to see some very funny Goodreads negative reviews, you can find quite a few. But yeah, it's a lot of very lengthy, very purple prose, according to most of these people. So just a warning for anyone who thinks, oh, this is going to be a philosophical work primarily. I would say it is, but it is not written that way. It reads as you are watching a nature documentary.
Yeah, it sounds really interesting. I'm gonna have to see if I can track down a copy sometime soon.
It won the Pulitzer, so hopefully it shouldn't be too
hard. Hopefully they're around.
My library has it actually, so I have it.
Look saved at that, on Cody's there. Already checking.
I'm already looking for it.
Here's the Goodreads review I wanted to share. Worst book ever. This pot-smoking chick had no idea what she was talking about. She may have said something relatively deep at a few points, but that is overshadowed by supreme stupidity. Why do I care about your muskrat fetish? She is a Thoreau wannabe, forgive my cliche, and just sucks in the process. If you are ever required to read this book, shoot yourself.
Oh my god.
Jesus.
Shoot yourself. Commit suicide.
Even if you don't like nature writing, that seems a little extreme.
Yeah.
A little bit, yeah.
That's definitely extreme.
And I have to say, I didn't read any of the muskrat stuff, because the muskrat stuff is sprinkled throughout the entire book, and so I would have to just, like, pull a paragraph out, and it wouldn't even begin to represent anything. But the muskrat stuff that he so hates to call it a muskrat fetish... It's incredibly beautiful, you know. Now, whenever I see a little pop into the water, I hope it's a muskrat, and then I remember that I don't live where muskrats live, and then I am you know, a little saddened, even though they have no personal connection to me.
They're just nice.
Yeah.
They seem like it, and she definitely makes them seem nice. So yeah, go read the book if you can, and if you can't, you know, go on a long walk. Spend a lot of time standing in the woods if there are any left around you. Yeah. Hope everyone enjoyed this rambling recommendation, and hope you enjoy next week's bonus episode as well. Bye.